I'm Mary Pellauer, and I want to welcome you to join us this week in thinking about issues related to healing after abuse. My topic this evening is sort of the basics about physical and sexual abuse, and someone earlier suggested that looking at the title, there was a slippage in his mind about whether or not it meant I was going to teach you the basics about how to abuse people. Hadn't occurred to me, but I could see once it had been pointed out that that was a problem. But I hope you all understood that our whole week's topic is healing and the healing process, because however important many facts and dynamics and other issues about physical and sexual abuse are, the most important single fact about these abuses in our society and the most important theological part is that people can heal from them. People do heal from them. They need not remain victims forever. And that there is a chance of newness of life that emerges for survivors. Let me just tell you a word or two about my plan for the four sessions that we have possible this week. Tonight is sort of introduction time. And I will be doing some numbers and some concepts and some sort of general things and throwing it open for our discussion. And then in the second session, we'll leap into the heart of the really important stuff and what I've called the sacred powers of healing, partly out of my sense that the healing process is a deeply important theological matter, and that when people are in the process of healing, they are in touch with some deep spiritual and theological capacities. And we'll talk a little bit about how those are shared among us. Then third, we'll spend a little concentrated time talking about what are some good guidelines for helping in the healing process or for enhancing the healing of others. And then we'll end on the last session, which I think is Saturday morning, on talking about ritual and healing. And I also mean that as a way of talking about, in a concentrated way, some of our Christian messages that get tangled up in the life stories of victims. So that's my plan. I want to also tell you a few words about myself. And I think before I do that, I want to share with you something like the watchword for me of this, all of these discussions about abuse of any kind. These lines come from a poet, Adrienne Rich. Many of you may know her poems, a book of poems called The Dream of a Common Language. And toward the end, there's a poem called Natural Resources, in which occur the lines that go like this. But many of us, in the desperation of our search, mistake passivity for gentleness. But gentleness is active. Gentleness swabs the crusted stump, invents more merciful instruments to touch the wound behind the wound, will not give up, keeps on bearing witness against the predator, the parasite. And it is that sense for me that gentleness is active, which I think I want to invoke for our time together, because many of the topics that we will be discussing this week are painful topics. They're hard to think about. They're very hard to experience. Sometimes they're so hard that we don't want to hear about them. We'd rather turn our ears off and turn our eyes away, which I think is to mistake passivity for gentleness. Sometimes we don't want to embarrass someone. We don't want to hurt them, so we look away or we do not ask. And I think it's important to remember that gentleness is active. Gentleness invents more merciful instruments to touch the wound behind the wound, will not give up. So let me begin by asking some things about those of us who are here in the room. I want to try and make this a safe space for us to talk about these issues. So I maybe want to start out by asking at the end of the sentence if people would raise their hand if it's appropriate. Have some of us here known someone who was a victim of sexual or physical abuse, or counseled someone who has been a victim or survivor of these abuses, or experience them themselves. I'm going to raise our hands if we... So it's pretty close to unanimous in this room. 20 years or so ago, what do you think we might have said? That's right.
The course wouldn't have been offered.
What?
The course wouldn't have been offered.
That's right. Yeah. A lot has happened in the last 20 years. And I want to say to you that that's a real important fact to me. It can be sort of sad and scary to see how many of us have raised our hands. And it's also a real important sign and indicator of hope, I think, that some things really have changed in the world and in the church in this time. In 1968, I was graduating from college and going off to be married and into graduate school. I was in graduate theological education for 4 or 5 years before I started hearing stories about battered women. And battered women in the early 70s were beginning to tell their stories. And I listened sort of in a distant way, like people were describing customs in New Guinea, perhaps. And as I listened to more and more of those stories, a very strange thing happened to me. I began to see pictures in the back of my mind of my mother and my father in the kitchen. And my father would have the butcher knife in his hand, and my mother would pick up the frying pan, no matter what was in it, dumping everything on the floor to try and hit that knife down. And I have pictures of him with a baseball bat in his hand, chasing my mother. And I began to realize that this was not just something that happened over there, someplace else that I should be listening to, like I was a tourist. But this was my life experience we were talking about. And I had not realized that. I had forgotten that, in fact, in the time of my going away to college, what I now see as trying to heal myself, to survive, to get away from the pain, and to learn to cope in a new way. But that sense that I hadn't known what had happened to me, and that I suddenly had a name that claimed my experience, was in a sense the beginning of healing for me. We talk about naming in the women's movement in theology these days. We talk about naming as a fundamental spiritual reality, a theological issue. Many of you may remember stories in the Old Testament that say Jacob wrestled with the angel all night long, and in the morning when the wrestling was over, he called the name of that place Bethel, right? Or there are many stories like this in the Old Testament where calling the name of something is a very important part of the story, and that's because the ancient people believed that the name had spiritual power. So in a sense, all of our being here tonight, all of our affirmations of our experience is a part of that deep spiritual change that's happening today to name our experience, to call upon a sacred power. So that's one sort of general introductory point. Let me tell you a few numbers that we've learned in the last 20 years. When I left home, I was absolutely certain that no one else had experienced what I'd experienced, that my parents were crazy, perhaps my father was a demon, perhaps my mother was a bitch. But that certainly no one else had had this experience. And that was part of the deep ugliness and wickedness and abnormality of my family. Now, 20 years later, we know quite a different thing. We've made some very important discoveries in this 20 years, some of which come to us from people who do statistics. And I'll try not to be boring about these. But let me just suggest to you that I, at least talking about physical and sexual abuse, and talking about a variety of kinds of abuses, sexual assault and rape, by which I mean in which the victim is an adult, sexual abuse, which could happen to adults, but which particularly perhaps happens to children, whether in the family or out of the family, battering, which we've learned to talk about in terms of adult persons, especially between two adult partners living together, either in marriage or not, and child abuse, which can be either physical or sexual, and maybe including some other things like sexual harassment on the job, and sexual exploitation by therapists and other professionals, including clergy. So there's a wide array now of abuses that we know about in our society and that we're beginning to work with. Let me just tell you some of the numbers. The best single source of numbers is a sociologist in the California area who 10 years ago now got a big grant to do a random sample of women in San Francisco. She was looking for indicators about marital rape, which no one had ever studied. And it turned out to be the first random sample study of women ever done on such topics. And the numbers that Diana Russell found were very astonishing. Still astonish me in a way. First of all, she discovered that using fairly conservative definitions about sexual assault, that of all the women in this study who had ever been married, who were married or had ever been married, 1 in 7 had been sexually assaulted by a husband or an ex-husband. And that when other kinds of non-marital rape were added to that, 2 in 5 of the women in this sample had experienced a completed or an attempted rape, many of them more than once. Of 1,000 women, there were 430 who had experienced sexual assault, and that 430 women had experienced a total of 2,588 incidents. Ooh. So 6 or more as an average, but some, of course, only one, and others as many as 12 or 18. Most common assailants, unlike what we usually think, most frequent offenders are husband or ex-husband, lover or ex-lover, acquaintance, relative, date, authority figure. These are in descending order, starting with husband or ex-husband, most frequent. Authority figure, boyfriend, stranger, friend, or friend of the family. I think it's really important to us to see that strangers accounted for only 6% of the total incidents of sexual assault experienced by these women. She also discovered a lot of information about battering. She was not asking about battering, but women started to talk about battering. And when you looked at the women who were married or had ever been married, and you put together their experiences of marital rape and battering, fully 1 in 4 of the women in the study who had ever been married had experienced violence at the hand of that spouse. Either rape or battering, or both. And women talked to her about experiences of abuse as children. Under the age of 18, 16% of all these women, or about 1 in 8, had been incestuously abused. Another 30% had been sexually abused by someone not a member of the family. When you put those two groups together, about 38% of the women in the study had been sexually abused before the age of 18. And of those women, how many do you want to guess had reported, had told someone about it?
None of them.
Zip.
5%.
2 to 4%. More likely to report if the attacker or assailant was not a member of the family. Mm-hmm. So we know that virtually all survivors of sexual abuse as children reach adulthood without telling anybody about it, which is a real important thing, I think, for many of us to be aware of. Let me also just say to you that there is some different research done about sexual abuse of boys. We know that boys and men are also sexually assaulted. In Minnesota, where I was a paraprofessional sexual assault counselor, something like 10% of the crisis calls that we got on the crisis line in Hennepin County were from men and boys. David Finkelhor, who's another student of sexual abuse, asking college frosh about their experiences, turned up about 1 in 11 of college freshman males who had been sexually abused before arriving at college.
Admitting.
What?
Admitting that they
had. Admitting, but it was a blind survey, and so he was pretty confident at least. Yeah. 1 in 11.
Because one study that I've seen recently suggests 1 in 7, mm-hmm. and they're saying that it could be her because the homophobic thing, mm-hmm. that boys are less likely to admit it even in a blind study.
Exactly. And in Minnesota, where I also did some prevention with kids, the people who really pioneered that program said when you did good prevention programs with kids in elementary school and gave permission to report, the numbers came closer to being 50-50.
Were these all by the same sex? In other words, males
assaulting
other males, or on the last study?
Pretty well. Pretty well. In fact, that's sort of true about sexual abusers in general. While it is not accurate to say that no women sexually abuse children, they're something like less than 1%. But we don't always know about that vast pool of men who don't report. But it seems as though the number of women abusers is very small. Also, Minnesota collected battering statistics. It's often asked how many men also are battered in the home, which is a good and important thing to keep in mind. And in 85 of the 33,000 individuals who reported to some reporting agency in Minnesota, 330 were men. So about 1% of the total people claiming physical battering between adults, about 1% of them were men. So there are some battered men out there. Did you want to add?
No, that gentleman asked if the men were assaulted by other men. I didn't think it would be by women, because women wouldn't be really strong enough to rape someone. I'm not sure that.
Well, let's think about that a moment.
When they're asleep, you can tie them up.
And several of the cases of marital rape that Diana Russell dealt with were cases of sexual intercourse while the woman was asleep or drugged or drunk, mm-hmm. in a no condition to consent. So being unconscious does make you vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Any numbers on the criminal population, on how they've been attended on abuse? I was thinking in comparison to your freshman and going into college.
There was a study just recently published in the PI in relation to this case with Judge Little that was brought out, that 85% of the prison population has experienced abuse of one form or another. 85% of all prisoners.
And that may be largely because that's a certain slice of the population. That
right.
is,
yeah.
It may be that men who have been abused in some way act out in some way that brings them to the attention of authorities.
Right.
Or it may be that some of us learn much more carefully how to cover up our symptomology. So it's not clear how representative those persons are. Sexual harassment studies, by the way, we're running about 44% of the women responding to studies have experienced one or more incidents of sexual harassment on the job. New and recent studies about abuse by psychotherapists and clergy, we're coming up with, it looks like somewhere between 10 and 15% of people who have been in psychotherapy have been sexually abused by a counselor. Any other numbers that people want to add, throw us into this mix, or questions that you might have? Those are real big numbers. When you start adding them together, when you start thinking 1 in 4 adult women in marriage may be physically abused, 1 in 7 may be raped, 2 in 5 of adult women that you know may be sexually assaulted, 2 in 5 women may be sexually harassed on the job, we're talking very large numbers in the population. And that in itself is a source of anxiety to me. I need to remember to breathe deeply whenever I start thinking about that. I encourage you all also to remember to breathe when you start feeling anxious, to breathe into your center, because I, at least when I get nervous and anxious, stop breathing, and this makes you more nervous and anxious. Go ahead.
Would you define sexual harassment on the job?
Yeah.
That's really a general general term.
Yeah.
I would think we'd have a lot of different definitions here.
Let's start up at the top and talk about sexual assault and abuses. This is going to be a strict definition, right? Any sexual contact without consent, which might be achieved by physical force, coercion, intimidation, lying, manipulation, trickery, deceit. Often little kids are not assaulted at gunpoint or knife point, but they are tricked or lied to in some way. Sexual harassment on the job has built into it the same in the federal and most state laws. It's defined as sexual contact without consent. then either that affects job performance or job evaluation in some way, or in the federal guidelines, has the result of making the workplace an intimidating or hostile environment.
What about verbal, just verbally, just the way an employer might talk to?
Innuendos and stuff like that.
I mean, would that be considered?
Those are considered sexual harassment on the job by law. And they are crimes. It's wonderful to kind of remember that this is a crime. Not many people.
Say that again, please. Just say
sexual harassment is a crime?
Yeah, okay. No, that's fine. I've got a friend back home I'm dealing with, and she's not. I'm not up on the rules, and she's not up.
These are all crimes we're talking about here, right? You know, it's one thing to say that it's a crime, and it's another thing to say that everyone is going to come out of the woodwork and prosecute. Diane Russell also found that of those sexual assault victims, 1 in 10 reported any of those incidents of sexual assault to the police or any other authority. And that's pretty much what the FBI has always said about adult rape, that 1 in 10 cases comes to the attention of the authorities. We don't know how many battering victims report, and certainly not, but nowhere near the number of sexual harassment victims report. Cases of sexual harassment that get to the courts and authorities is very small. Largely because it's a very difficult process.
Is there much sexual harassment by women to men on jobs and stuff?
A good study of sexual harassment from the feds in the GSA indicated that something like 15% of the total people who reported some sexual harassment were men reporting being harassed by women. But also on the job we have men sexually harassing other men, and sometimes, although more rarely, women sexually harassing other women. Now, back up there at that definition of things where I say that I'm talking about any sexual contact without consent, I think it's very important for us to recall, to just be clear for a minute about what this movement that we're in the middle of has looked at and has tried to be clear about. When we are talking about sexual assault, what is painful, what is damaging about sexual assault is not the sexuality part, but the assault part. It is an attack, an assault, an intrusion in which sexuality is used as the weapon. Not that it's sexual per se, but that we're talking about violence and violation in which the most intimate part of someone's self is being coerced, is being harmed, is being used as a violent and violating tactic. That's important to understand because in the last 20 years, our whole new understandings of these issues has come from the testimony of many survivors who said over and over again, "It wasn't like this was sex. I thought he was trying to kill me." It's experienced as violent. It's experienced often as a threat on the life or well-being, physical well-being of the person being harmed. And so we're talking here not about sexual disorders, if you will, but we're talking about disorders of power and domination. And it's real important to try and get that straight. It's something I need constantly to reprocess through my mind because I will sometimes slip about that also. And because it's sexual violence, and our society does not clearly distinguish sexual violence from sexuality, it's sometimes hard for us to get that straight. And because in our society there's a gray area in the middle in which people don't know whether what they've experienced is sexuality or sexual violence. It's not uncommon, for instance, on a crisis line to have someone call up and say, "I'm so upset, but I don't know if I really even should be calling you. I'm not sure if I was raped or not, because he didn't have a gun. He didn't have a knife. He just weighed 220 pounds and he wouldn't take no for an answer." Not taking no for an answer is pretty common in our culture, isn't it? There's a therapist who works with rapists who's been very pioneering in generating all kinds of new stuff about rapists, who says as he tries to re-educate rapists, rapists in prison now, we're talking convicted rapists, and they raise their hands and they say, But how do we know when she means no, when she says no? And Nick Gruff says in public that he tells them when she says no three times, then she's serious, right? Now, how many times do you think we need to say no before someone takes us seriously? One time would be enough, wouldn't it? Hopefully one time. But we are confused in our society about whether or not it's okay for women to consent to sex that they want. And because of that confusion, it's often easy in our stereotypical society to say, well, she really wants it, but she just isn't, you know, ready to say yes. But that's a myth. That's a rationalization that runs around in our society that doesn't allow women the right to determine our own lives in lots of different ways. Some things people want to add or comment on or object to.
How do you distinguish sexual violence or harassment from violence or harassment in general? And what is the distinction?
Say some more about what your question is.
Well, I think, for instance, sexual harassment, how do you distinguish that? Is it, you say, by sexual innuendos, or is that by, give an example.
Well, I see what your question is. There is a concern about the law, because the law says that the person who determines that this is sexual harassment is the victim. It is in the victim's perception that sexual harassment is going on, and therefore she brings a complaint. That doesn't mean that the court is going to determine that she's got a case. But also, when I say that sexual assault has to do with any sexual contact without consent, that means that I am giving to the victim the right to determine what consent is.
And if it's sexual.
And probably sexual means pretty much what we mean by sexual. It's anything to do with one's sexual organs or sexual parts. When we teach little kids about sexual abuse prevention, we usually say anything, touching anything that's covered by a bathing suit under ordinary conditions. Did you have some other sense of what might be sexual that you wanted to
add? No, I think that often people's fear, or society's fear of being falsely accused.
And what are you supposed to
do? Defining
that?
The lines of that, both by, you know, giving permission and whether the victim, you know, gave permission or not, and also what's defined as being sexual, and what's being abusive that way, if patting someone, if touching someone in certain areas versus not others. Or
yep, that's right. There are lots of issues in there. Some of you have the experiences or messages from the church or from the media or anywhere else about false accusations? Remember the biblical story? There's an Old Testament story. I don't know if Terry Fredheim is going to take this one up this week. About a gentleman who the story says was falsely accused of rape. Do you remember that story? Some of you do, right? What is the story? Joseph was in captivity in the land of Egypt. And Potiphar's wife looked on him with lust and snuck around one night to say, hey, what about it, baby? And Joseph, being an upright man, said no and tried to get away. And she grabbed his robe and he whipped out and left her with the evidence there so that she could tell her husband that Joseph had tried to rape her. Look, he left his garment here. Potiphar's wife in that story hangs over us a lot in this society, I think, leaving us with a strong sense that women are going to falsely accuse men of rape and that you need to be suspicious of women's word. And in fact, in the laws in our society, up until this women's movement, in the early 70s, almost every state in the union had in its rape laws a corroboration clause. She could not bring a rape charge unless there was corroboration by one or more witnesses. And since this is a crime in which people take rather great care to make sure they're not being observed, made it very difficult. for people to bring charges. And maybe also makes those of us who are women nervous about whether or not people are going to believe us if we say someone has sexually abused us or harassed us.
What about date rape? I've heard a lot about, I've seen articles in the paper about, I forget what percentage it was, but quite a large percentage.
Yeah, I don't remember those percents either, and I forgot to bring them along. Does anyone remember this material about date rape? I recall it, about the young men, there were sort of sliding scales. I have used violence. I might use violence. If I could get away with it, I might use violence. And if you put all of those together, got about half of the young men responding to the study saying that.
Yeah, it was a pretty high percentage.
51% said that they would if they thought they could.
If they thought they'd get away with it, yeah. And I remember it as something like 30% of the young women said they had experienced some sexual activity that they had not wanted on the part of the date. Something like that. Yes.
Recently, and I don't know any of the specifics about it, but maybe somebody else does it. There was a study of junior high students asked about things like, you know, when can you kiss someone, and can someone refuse? And there were general attitudes that young people, junior high students, would have at their age about expectations of, you know, I think the response was, if you go out with a girl and spend $20 on her, you can, you have the permission to kiss her, or, I mean, was that kind of thing? Do you know about that?
I don't, Carol. It sounds fascinating.
It was astounding that these young children had very scary attitudes.
Because the more they spent, the more rights they had to ignore the wishes of them.
And more time they spent with
them. I think it was 85%, if I remember correctly. I thought it was 15 to 18 year olds. What I recall. But in the study, if you're dated a girl and spent lots of money on her, do you have a right to expect sex? And 85% said yes.
Mm-hmm. And then they did something, a prevention solution. And ran by another survey afterwards. Did you read a similar article?
And it cut down a big percent.
Yes,
in half or something like that, I think.
The perceptions changed.
Really important
factor. Mm-hmm. Something that, just about the question of the woman wondering if she mentions or you know, goes out and states what's happened, whether or not she'll feel she's believed, that I think parallels that is that the guilt that a woman may feel wondering if she caused her own victimization. Mm-hmm. And so she feels shame and guilt, mm-hmm. which again prevents her from becoming clear mm-hmm. as to what her wishes were. Mm-hmm.
And it is pretty hard to report. It is still pretty hard to talk about these issues. And in some ways we've opened up a lot of new freedom to talk about these issues in the last 20 years, but there still is some difficulty.
A lot of the bigger cities will have a woman on staff with the police force that can talk to somebody like this, but in the smaller cities, you're talking to men mm-hmm. about something that they think, you know, like good old boys or something, you know.
Yeah.
Redneck policeman or something. Mm-hmm.
Or that it may simply be modesty or the sense of whether or not this person will understand, or does this person identify with me enough to understand mm-hmm. so I feel comfortable? It's not always that you think the cops are macho, nasty people, but it just may be a sense that I can tell another woman about this more
easier,
readily.
Yeah.
I was a police officer for 16 years with a fairly large department, and I can say that there were incidents above the anecdotal level of what I guess you could call false or malicious reporting of sexual assault. And I think the thing that comes to mind more than anything is the borderline personality that's depicted in the movie Fatal Attraction. It seems to be the type of personality that would use the system to manipulate a relationship. And
I don't
it
know
is
that
not,
movie.
Oh, yeah. And I don't want to say that it's real common, but it is not uncommon. The other problem that
oh, stop a second.
Yeah.
I don't know what you mean by not uncommon. People who look at reporting in general across the whole field of criminality suggest that the rate of false reporting about rape is no different than the rate of false reporting about any other crime. That is to say, it runs about 2%. And that means it really... 2% are false accusations. Now, in the case of actually all crimes, there is some oddness about this because it's often up to the officer who is called to decide whether or not the case is founded and therefore goes on to a detective. So there's still a little slippage in the system at the point of first response of the system. So whether or not the system gives attention may depend on the feelings or the responses of the officer. So that I just wanted to be sure we got into some clarity about what it meant to say it's not uncommon.
Yes. It, the other issue regarding the system and prosecution is that we are still in an area where when we hang an unfounded or unprosecutable label on a particular case, that doesn't mean that it did not occur. What it means is that there may not be evidence that can be presented in a court of law that is able to bring forth any kind of chance of a meaningful prosecution. One-on-one date rapes are a great example because he says, hey, we were in her apartment, she invited me in at 2:00 in the morning, and I was given permission. And she says, no, I invited him up for coffee. And at that point, the system has to say, we can't do anything about that. We have no way of dealing with that.
Well, that is what the system does say. I don't know if that's what the system has to say. But the reality of the facts of our present system are pretty much what you described. The more closely related you are to the assailant, the less likely it is that it's going to be prosecutable in the sense of getting through the court of law. And that is just a reality about who reports and how they feel about the reporting process. Yeah. Did you want to add?
No.
I thought you were raising your hand.
Yeah, I was. I'm real concerned about domestic sexual abuse that starts with in childhood. And the enormous difficulty of coming to grips with that with any kind of legal processes, and particularly insofar as that it sometimes marks a woman for a lifetime of victimization. Are there any ways that are proving effective within, say, church or school to begin to address that taboo?
Yeah, the kids might think it's normal. I mean,
domestically.
I mean, they may think it's a normal procedure. So, I mean, if they grew up with it all their lives. You know.
And that's very common, actually.
Yeah.
That whoever is the perpetrator, was this table?
No.
This is going to fall. Let me know, would you? Often says that this is how daddies behave. This is what daddies teach little girls. You know, this is how grandfathers show their love, or uncles, or whatever. So it often is, this is that deceit element that I've put in the definition up at the top, right? Very clearly lying and manipulating someone into believing that this is normal and they shouldn't object, even though it feels bad.
Or just keeping the secret.
Mm-hmm.
Another factor that goes along with that is the mother who, whether consciously or unconsciously, turns her face the other way, because if she faces what's happening, she may lose her support. You know, the husband is doing to the child, but if it all comes out and the husband has to go, then, you know, she's kind of stuck between. She doesn't like what's happening to her child, but, gee, if this all comes out and my husband leaves, then I'm stuck with the kids by myself, and then what do I do?
Or if the child's uncle is doing something and she doesn't want to turn in her brother. You know, there's a whole bunch of...
When we're talking about a breadwinner, I think it's especially hard, and sort of reminds me of the material you were reporting about adolescence, that we often still think that there is an implicit exchange going on in intimate relationships of sex for money. It's real hard. Some of you, it sounds like lots of you, are very au courant. I wish you would help to add things to this. There is a very wonderful line in the study of incest by a Boston therapist named Judy Herman, who did one of the first in-depth studies of about 40 women incest victims. And when she gets down to the end of the text and says, what do we need to do to stop this? She has a very wonderful line that says, as long as fathers rule but do not nurture, and mothers nurture and do not rule, the conditions for incest are set up in our families. Which is one of those things that leads me to try and think about what is it we're doing in our families and how we relate to families, and where do we get that sense of entitlement or not entitlement? It looks like women pretty well observe the incest taboo, and that men, by and large, do not observe it. And that that's a very peculiar something about what we've got going on in our society. Women, by and large, do not sexually abuse kids. We may physically abuse kids. And let me just toss in that there is some data about women, depending on how you count, women may be at parity with their husbands for physically abusing their kids. Or if you count by hours of exposure of the parent to the children, it looks like women are still less likely to be physical abusers in terms of the number of hours we spend with kids all day long. But still, there's no way around it. Women sometimes physically abuse their little kids. But sexually, we inhibit ourselves.
Right over here.
Yeah.
I just finished working at a place with children. They're labeled emotionally disturbed, but 99.9% of them were all sexually abused. And they're little kids, 5 to 13. Mm-hmm. And there was definitely more than one case where the woman was the perpetrator, and mm-hmm. it wasn't necessarily like an intercourse type thing. I learned a lot about boundaries, mm-hmm. and that these women don't have a sense of where they stop and where their little boy starts. Mm-hmm. And the boy never learns any kind of boundaries either, and you sleep with mom all the time, and you just become one. And there was one boy who will pick up whoever's personality he's with, because he's so used to just becoming mom when he's with her, and he acts like a little girl and all this kind of stuff. And you know, so I saw a few cases there of where the woman was the abuser.
That's real helpful. Thank you for adding that. The issue about boundaries that you raised is a larger one. I mean, I think it runs like a thread through many of these kinds of abuses, that there is some difficulty about accepting the boundary or having a firm boundary. When women say no, and no is not taken as no, then your boundaries are being violated. And similarly, often in families where there is incest going on, it seems as though people have a difficult time setting appropriate boundaries, having their personal space respected, for instance. Did you want to add?
Yeah, and just adding to that, I participated in a study done by Oregon CSD on child abuse victims and child abusers, and it seems that it is a learned behavior, that the child abuser very often was, 90-95% of them were victims themselves of abuse, and that cycle carries on, and this is a familial thing that carries on. If a child is abused, he may model and learn that behavior, that is proper and appropriate for an adult.
You used the masculine pronoun there. Did you mean to say that happens, that's the cycle that happens in young men?
When did I say that?
You said the child, he.
He or she.
Because, in fact,
yeah.
While in physical abuse, it looks a little bit more clear that we get an intergenerational thing going on, in sexual abuse, it's not necessarily the case. Women sexually abused as children do not grow up to become abusers. And this is the big problem with the intergenerational theory, that everybody doesn't follow the intergenerational model.
No.
So that's...
Yeah, well, I'm talking about physical abuse in that case. This is where we're talking about physical injury to children.
Yeah, that is much... Tammy, you wanted to say something?
Well, I wanted to go back to what Eldon was saying before, you know, that maybe one of the things that is leading into some sort of space for this healing to happen in our society is that it is being talked about, you know, and that people are taking upon themselves an individual responsibility when they see it happening, not to turn the other way. I know of a woman who said that when she sees someone being physically harmed, children being really spanked hard or, you know, cuffed and where they fall against something, that she will go up to the child and look into its eyes and say, "That must have hurt very much." Never talking to the adult, because there was a case where a young girl whose father was very abusive were sitting in this fancy restaurant, and she displeased her father, and he kicked her around the entire restaurant, around the tables, and finally kicked her out of the door. And she said the thing that she remembered the most was that all of these very well-dressed people did not even look at her, did not even notice that this child was being violated. And that is what she remembers. And she said ever since she heard that story, she will never, ever see a child being in any way violated without going up to the child, because that will make some kind of connection. And I think that where you find healing happening, usually within that family, there's been a healer, someone who has not drawn back from entering the abuse themselves and taking on themselves, actually, the abuse that's happening to the child. As I heard of a grandmother to this small child, every day she heard her being violated with straps and who knows what. The grandmother went in every single day, and she was beating herself. But for that, one of those reasons, this girl is becoming whole. She remembers that someone cared crazily about her. And I think we have to remember that as individuals and as churches, too. The churches don't close their hearts to people like that.
I think people in general just need to get more involved when they see something like that and not step back. I mean, there's, you know, people being murdered in New York, and people just, you know, like, draws a crowd. I mean, they need to...
And lots of people want to get in on that.
And the important thing to remember, you know, people get involved and report, and I've also worked with emotionally disturbed in the last two kids in the last 2 years, and I'd say again, like she, 99% of our kids have been physically and or sexually abused, and that's not even counting the neglect and verbal abuse that goes on hourly at their house. Reporting it, at least in this state, doesn't have a whole lot of effect. Because there is not money to deal with the kids. If there's a real set case of sexual abuse, the kid gets taken out of the home, not the offender, the majority of the time. So the kid is made to feel as if they are the ones who did something wrong. So it's not just get involved, it's get involved and change the whole system as to how these kids are dealt with.
What state are you talking about?
Washington.
But my wife has said that's true all over, just about. I mean, that's in all the states.
That's pretty common because it's easier.
I think maybe a question I'd like to have you meditate, and we have about 5 more minutes, but something we might meditate on as we look toward thinking about the healing process is I have a sense that there's a lot of motivation in this room to be helping people to... make it better, to enhance people's coming out alive and well and healthy. And I just would like to drop into the well for a minute a thought to you about whether or not we think healing is fixing it. Or whether or not we have to distinguish maybe between participating in someone's healing as much as we can and rescuing. Because I think the sad fact often is that, like the grandmother intervening from next door, it's sometimes not possible to stop it. That stopping it is something I want to hold out for us as a sign of a goal or a symbol of the kingdom of heaven or something like that, although I think something we can attain. But that part of what goes on for us is that we need somehow to cope with the grieving that we do, that we can't stop every case, that this stuff is going on right now, that with however much goodwill we have, or expertise even sometimes, we might not be able to make it stop right now. But that also Sammy, I think Sammy has a good point about if someone tells a story about abuse and you hear it, even to intervene in such a simple way as to validate the feelings, there is a sense of a healing step that's taken. If you're being abused and you tell everyone about it and no action happens, people feel re-victimized, as if the system had raped them over again, as though the parish pastor was colluding with the battering victim, so that there's a dimension in all this in which our social participation can either betray survivors again or can help them a step forward on their process. That was a little sermon I just got off.
You had made a comment about that women who have been victims of sexual abuse, you know, very low percentage become abusers. I wanted to interject that instead of becoming abusers, they perpetuate their victim cycles in relationships as they grow up and as adults. The other thing I wanted to coattail on was the child being kicked around the restaurant and the child being removed from the house rather than the abuser, and that is society's denial of really being willing to address and to confront that something's wrong.
Why do you think we deny?
We don't want to face it.
What?
We don't want to face it, I think, is probably one of them. We don't want to admit that it happens.
It hurts.
It takes time.
It's too hard to change.
Too hard to change me, like the whole situation or us or
a particular situation. It's hard to reach out. You cannot really change the situation. It's painful to relate to that person.
Other?
Well, we started out by talking about how far we've come, and now we reverse and talking about how far we have to go. And I think that's typical of our society. Okay, here's a problem. Well, let's solve it right now. Take care of it. And things don't happen that fast. You know, this old Sesame Street generation stuff. You know, we want things to happen right now and quickly. And we've come a long way. We look at the educational system, teachers, just legally, that if they suspect something, have to report it. You know, that's a step forward.
Yeah.
That things like this happening and people being more aware and the fact that children are admitting what's happening to them, whereas years ago they didn't. You know, those are all steps forward, but it's going to take a long time. And we have to keep going forward and keep doing things, but isn't going to happen right now.
Well, isn't it just a short time ago the police didn't even come to the house if it was a domestic quarrel? But now in the state of Washington, isn't it, that when somebody assaults somebody, that whoever assaults goes for one night to jail?
Yeah, somebody has to be taken to jail.
Yeah. And that has apparently really put down there.
Yes, that's the Domestic Intervention Project in Minnesota. That's what it's called anyway. Do you want to add?
Yeah, I think a big problem is the real resistance to any kind of sexual education in schools. People are just nuts about that. You know, they say if we teach any kind of sex education, then the kids are going to go out and have sex.
Well, somebody wrote, Dear Abby, instead her child was 13, was it time to tell her about the birds and the bees? And she said it'd be kind of like teaching a fish how to swim. Or something along that line.
We do have some difficulty, though, talking about when we do prevention with kids, for instance. One of the things to say to parents very out front is you have to talk to your kids about sex, and it includes things like telling them names for their body parts. Because a little kid who doesn't know the names for their body parts can't report that they're being fondled by someone. So a sense of having a matter-of-fact way of talking about these issues can help.
Yeah, I was really impressed with Minnesota. I think they implemented a law that they would teach education about AIDS from kindergarten to 12th grade. And I think really education is the way to go. I think it's the only way that change is going to be brought about.
On the education there, I think that's nice, but part of the points that were made in this week's edition of the Parade magazine, that was your Sunday supplements, the Sunday Parade, and it was a feature cover, where the cover story was of teenage pregnancy and what adults didn't get from a 15-year-old, they got. The point that she was making, she did get some birth control pills, so she did have some sexual education, you know, the functioning aspect. What she really was lacking was the morals, that is, really bringing to her, she got the dry facts, but you know, they still didn't really set in context, no place for her to put them. This, what does it really mean to have my life, my youth destroyed and have instant adulthood thrown on me with a kid? The values, she did not have a sense of values or plate or perspective to put all this in, that's what she was missing. And a question that came up earlier, what is the church doing about this?
Let's just get one of those at a time.
Okay, you're running out of time.
Yeah, we are running out of time, and this feels important to me. In the city of Chicago in the last year, one of the major agencies working with teen pregnancies asked those teens about sexual abuse in the family. And 80% of the young women who were pregnant in their teens had been sexually abused by a family member or some other friend of the family, someone in an intimate relationship with them. And in that context into which I'd like to drop your comment about morals, because if you don't learn that you have a moral right to say no, then the foundation of your ethical development is not present. And there's a deep, intrusive violation on the basis of which we cannot talk about morality and ethics in the same context that we ordinarily do on a Sunday morning.
Okay, I'd like to continue just real quick on that. The thing is to do something about it. There are about 35 people in this room that have an opinion on this subject. Well, that's why we're here, and I think you've had a higher percentage of group contribution than I've seen in the other studies. The thing is, this is a case where we really can do something about it, and it can be done individually. The idea where you set up the quote where it said, where the father does not nurture, but is a position of authority, I can't quite say it. I cannot envision myself contributing to change the whole lifestyle of a community like that. I mean, that's beyond, I see, my reach. But I can set up a good educational system in my church that helps gently lead in or provide effective studies to the families, and something simple like how to report child abuse, how to tell no to a stranger you can't touch certain part of your bodies, or how to begin introducing values. This can be done through your church, through like a 2-4-6 week educational program, part of your communication or Sunday school program. It's really simple to do. And also, if nothing else, have a very simple, you know, 1-3 week course for parents to show up how to teach your kids or how to ask. This can be done. I can't see changing the moral structure of a family, but I can see providing the tools for the family to work to do that.
You wanted to add?
I want to step in. You're addressing what you would do to teach the children. I would like to see what would be addressed to help to teach us as a society. Within our churches would be a good place to start. Help to teach men to become more nurturing, and help teach women to be able to take on the power that is their right to say no and to have control over their own lives. Because unless children see that exhibited in their mothers, they will not feel that empowerment.
Absolutely. And the Senate already has this right now. Your local Senates have this capacity. And what she's saying, what I'm saying, they can give it to you. They can give you the course outline right now.
We need to declare this formally finished. I actually have 9:50 on my clock. But let me drop into the mix again another thing for you as we think about healing in the next session, if some of you will be generous enough to come back. let's just think a little bit about some larger capacities that we have. I mean, yes, action is one of them. But let me provoke you to think for a couple of days, if you will, about a line by a very early feminist, Mary Wollstonecraft, in the middle of the Vindication of the Rights of Women, has a wonderful little line that is about violence. She says, "Those who are able to see pain unmoved will soon learn to inflict it." I just would like to drop that into your mix to think about prevention and what some of our larger capacities for living are that might be ordinary capacities and play a part in healing. Okay?